The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
Good evening. How's everybody doing tonight? Good? A little tired? It's been a full day, but it's great to see all of you here tonight. God has more things for us, and I'm looking forward to our time together this evening. Tonight, in case you're wondering if you're in the right room, you're in a seminar titled A Biblical Perspective on Business. And we have two gentlemen leading us tonight. The first is Bill Pollard, who all of us, I think, heard this afternoon. Because only people with blue stickers could get in there, and only people with blue stickers can get in here tonight. So, welcome. I'm going to give him the short introduction, like he requested earlier. He is the husband of his wife and the father of four children, and I can't tell you the number of grandchildren.
15.
Wow. Our second contributor tonight is Al Ehrsman. Al is the director of the Center for Integrity in Business at Seattle Pacific University and the publisher of Ethics Magazine. He spent 32 years at the Boeing Company, where he retired in 2001 as director of Mathematics and Computing Research and Development. He's been involved in global business missions with InterVarsity, co-leading teams to Southeast Asia, Central Africa. He and his wife, Nancy, live in Bellevue, Washington, where they raised their four children and now spend time with seven grandchildren. And my name's Don Paul Gross. I'm not the one you came to hear, but I work for InterVarsity staff. And I just want to welcome you. Let me open our time in prayer. Father, we're grateful for the grace that you've shown us in many ways. And today, the way you've given us strength, the way you've provided for us, both physically and spiritually and mentally. And Lord, as we've been drinking deeply, we ask that you would open our minds and our hearts, that we might drink some more from your goodness, from the things that you want to teach us as individuals and as a community. Father, I do ask that you would speak through Bill and Al, and that our hearts would be open to what you have for us. In Christ's name we ask these things. Amen. They're going to lead us in our time together, and then there will be a time for question and answer. So let's welcome them to the seat.
Can you hear me? Is that on? We're going to do this a little differently tonight. I don't have any of these PowerPoints to throw up, so it's just me and Al. That's all you have there. And we're going to have, really, Al's got some difficult questions that I'm not even sure what they are that they're going to ask me. And that's to prompt you all to be thinking about questions that you'd like to ask so that we end up having a dialogue. And frankly, when I teach, I usually am not sitting up here like this. I'm usually walking around with the students that I'm teaching. And if you don't ask a question and you're sitting in the front row, I'll ask you a question. Fair enough. So think about the questions that you'd like to ask of us, and if they're too hard for me, I've always got Al I can refer to. I'll get back at it if he asks me too hard. I'd like to start out tonight with a question for you, and then give you a little story about how it was answered in my environment. How many of you are actually in business right now? Okay, wonderful. Okay, so let's just assume that we're sitting on a plane together. I don't know you. And you sit down and I ask you, what is your business? What would your answer be?
It's a hydrogen storage delivery technology.
Hydrogen? Storage, delivery,
technology
company. That is a mouthful. That sounds like it's really complicated. Okay? Who else was in business that raised their hand? What would you say? What?
Fansite.
What is that?
It's a website dedicated towards...
It's a website dedicated towards... Okay, so it's encouraging interchange in a network community, okay? Who else? Real estate, meaning you're selling real estate, buying real estate?
No,
agent, broker, or?
No, I'm a marketing director. We invest in real estate for pension funds.
Oh, you invest in real estate for pension funds. So you work for the pension fund?
No, I work for the investment advisor.
Investment advisor, okay. To help them make good investments in real estate.
Right, they give us a large sum of money and they go to them.
That's great. That's a great job. Somebody gives you a lot of money and you can go out and invest it. That's a great job. Who else would like to answer that question for a minute? Yes?
I'd like a real estate investor to know that I manage real estate.
Okay, you manage real estate. That's what you do. You manage real estate. Well, let me tell you a story about what is your business. This is a famous Peter Drucker question. You've all heard about Peter. Most of you have heard about Peter Drucker. One of the great privileges I had in life was to get to know him well. He was a mentor of mine, and I often had an opportunity to go out into his living room and have discussions with him about the business, get his advice, and so forth. And there was a time in our company, it was in the early 1990s, when we were going through another planning period, and we were trying to set some objectives, goals for the future, and so... I thought it would be a great idea if we got our board of directors and our senior officers for a two-day session with Peter Drucker. And now, to give you an idea, some of you probably know what ServiceMaster does, but among other things, at that point, what we were doing is we did maintenance and cleaning work in hospitals, serving a little over 1,500 hospitals, most of them in the U.S., but also overseas in England and Japan. Other countries. So that was one of our businesses. Some of you may have identified us with our yellow trucks running around the country, cleaning up floors. That's our franchise business. We have 4,500 franchisees cleaning up after fire and floods and also cleaning carpets. Carpet is dirty. That's another part of the business. And then Terminex is one of our businesses, so we kill bugs. And True Green Kevlon is one of our businesses, so we kill weeds. We fertilize lawns. And then the American Home Shield, which is a business that basically sells you a warranty. It will come and repair your appliances. If something goes wrong with your appliances or your furnace in your house, for $1 a year, you can buy a warranty. It'll sell something after the program is made. And Mary Mays is one of our businesses. You know what Mary Mays is? It's maid service. So they're all service related. And many of our businesses, we're dealing with entry-level employees coming into business, especially in the cleaning side of it as well. So, Peter Drucker hit our distinguished board there, and our senior officers, and he started out with his first question, what is your business? Now, three questions are, what is your business, who is your customer, and what does your customer see as value? They're great questions to ask of any business. But he asked our board, what is your business? And our board members began answering exactly how all of you answered by what we did. Some said, well, we clean floors. Well, we kill bugs. Well, we kill weeds. And after about 5 minutes, he said to our board, you're all wrong. Something I've never been able to tell. He said, you're in the business of training and developing people. You can't deliver a service without people, and you can't deliver a quality service without trained and motivated people. You package it all different ways to meet the needs of your customer, But your basic business is the training and development of people. Now, you heard what our objectives were. Honor God in all we do, to help people develop, pursue excellence, and grow profitably. First two being end goals, and the second two being means goals. So we had always incorporated that in the business, and we spent a lot of time, effort, and money on training and developing people. But we never quite said, this was our business. We never put it that way. This was our business. And when you look at it that way, what is the next question?
How is your training?
How is your training? Okay. Even a deeper question than that. Who are these people you're training and developing? And not just what they do and how they do it, but why do they work? Who are they, and why do they work? And you see, when you start asking those questions, where does the answer to that question ultimately lead you? When you ask the question, who are people, where does that ultimately lead you? Knowing someone better, yeah. But who else? What else does it ultimately lead you? Where did we come from, and where are we going? Where does that ultimately lead you? I mean, eventually I'm going to get to God, right? I mean, you see, when you say that. Your business is people. And I bet you I could go around this room and all of you in business, you'd come back and say, yeah, that's a good way to describe our business. We do these other things. But if you think you can get your business done without people, then, you know, after New Year's, go home and give everybody a 2 weeks vacation and you do the job. You can't, right? You can't run a business without people. By the way, you can't typically have a business without customers. Customers are people, right? So, yes. Jeff, Henry Ford's famous comment. Why is it I get a whole person when all I really wanted is a pair of hands?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Oh, the question, I'm sorry. Her question was, do I think this is? There are a lot of companies that don't think this way. That was her question, and then she was referring to the Henry Ford comment that Jeff made, and that's true. A lot of companies don't think that way. It's very easy to think about people as a cost of labor. That line P&L on your P&L that says cost of labor. You know that if that cost of labor goes up, your profits go down, and the cost of labor goes down, and you can still do the same job and they're more productive, your profits go up. It's the further, the bigger you get, the further and further away you get from the people making it happen. So it can be an easy phenomenon that happens. Yes?
Is that the approach of the classical approach where you're making the products and then expect people to buy it? That same type of concept where you're gearing towards expect people to work. Find workers no matter where you're at. That same type of philosophy? Or?
Well, it's certainly a philosophy that recognizes that every person has been created in the image and likeness of God. No matter what they believe, no matter where they came from, no matter what their nationality is, no matter what their skin color is, no matter how tall they are, no matter how short they are, no matter how, quote, smart they are on an IQ test. Every person has been created in the image and likeness of God with dignity and worth. When you start having a diversity policy in a company and you start there, it all of a sudden transforms all of what you're talking about with respect to diversity. You're not talking about diversity because there's a law that says you've got to protected class to be concerned about. You're talking about diversity because this is part of the way God created us. So, the other thing it does is it makes you think about what is the meaning and purpose of business. Now, that got a little bit to Jeff's comments to us today. And I think I'm going to stop here, Al, and let you begin asking the questions.
All right. I was given the wonderful task of asking him a few questions, and I have interviewed Bill before. I don't know if any of you have seen Ethics Magazine, but this issue before the latest one features Bill, and I would be glad to get a copy to you. How many of you have read the book, The Soul of the Firm? There is a couple hundred people that really ought to buy that book.
Right.
It is a wonderful, wonderful story. We're going to have trouble getting to know Bill tonight because he will give you answers to all of your questions, and we'll see a little corner, and I'd love you to see the whole thing. So if we don't get everything out here tonight, go buy the book and read it. I'd encourage you. Or look at this. What's that? The Soul of the Firm? Soul of the Firm? Bill Pollard, it's 84 or something like that?
It was published in 94.
94. And there's another book out which we will talk about in just a moment. So my first question to Bill was, he's been in business a long time, and you have done the thing about running a company. What do you agree with and what do you disagree with out of what Jeff Enduser said this afternoon about the purpose of business?
Well, Al, this is the only question he told me he was going to ask. So he gave me a little bit of preparation. So I was badly taking notes with Jeff. No. You know, I resonate with what Jeff said. I think he hit the nail on the head. I think Jeff and Al and some others out of Seattle Pacific are working on this whole concept of the theology of business. And you heard today a construct of that. I'd like to have had the time to probe a little deeper on some things he said. Let me suggest some areas I'd like to probe a little deeper. I agree 100% with the concept that profit is a means. It's not an end. What does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? No man can serve two masters, God and money. Which is, by the way, the title of my new book, Serving Two Masters, Reflections on God and Profit. Profit is also essential. Profit isn't just something, oh, by the way, it's nice if we have it. Profit is essential, or you do not have sustainability. And it's not only essential for a business, it is essential for a community. It is essential for your home. If in your family you are spending more than you are taking in, you are in the process of going bankrupt. The collapse of the Soviet Union was primarily a financial collapse. It went bankrupt. If there was no profit, there would be nothing for the government to tax. Nothing for the government to tax. Or if they did tax, it would be confiscatory. They'd be taking property from you. If there wasn't profit, there would be no contributions, donations to InterVarsity. Profit is essential. And I don't think I don't think I was able to probe that deep enough,
right,
Jeff.
It would be good if you did.
Okay. So I think that was one point. And I also think that profit is a measure of effectiveness. And I think Jeff indicated that he may not look at profit as a metric. I do think it is a measure of effectiveness. If you are doing an activity and it is consistently unprofitable, it probably ought to be stopped. And so I do think that is, and you know, you can measure profit a variety of ways. We normally just think of measuring it in money, but it's a question of whether your activity is productive. Productive is a good biblical word, by the way. We're told to be productive in our lives. I think the parable of the talents is an example of the way God looks at the necessity of a return. You remember that parable, of course. One servant had 5 talents and multiplied it to 10. One had 2 and multiplied it to 4. And then one was so afraid that he buried it. And the master not only condemned him for that, but he condemned him for the fact that he didn't even put it in the bank for interest. And I believe the principle there is that God expects a return in our lives. He's not giving us talents and gifts, opportunities for us just to give those back to Him. He wants more. He wants us to take our talents and our gifts and make more of it, not just the same that we received. And now I'm talking about profit in a whole other concept than what you normally think about in a business. But it's the same principle. And that is that if there is a resource, the resource should be invested and there should be a return. And when it comes to our lives, we're called upon to invest our lives for a return. And we can, instead of investing our lives, we can spend our lives where there's no return. And the wonderful mystery of it all is God has given us that choice. But that's a reality. Because God in the end owns it all. Psalm 24 confirms it for you. If you have any question about that. He owns you. He owns me. He owns everything He's given us.
So as a company, you have a value that stated you would honor God in all that you do, yet you were a publicly traded company and you had non-Christians. How did you explain this?
Well, first of all, we had customers who were non-Christians too.
Right.
We were serving in a market that had non-Christians.
Okay.
We were serving in a world that was non-Christians. We had a principle. We said we pay based upon performance, promote based upon potential. Your faith has nothing to do with it. So the way we ran the business is that we were very much of an inclusive environment. At the same time, we did not shy away from that first objective. It was there. And it constantly asked the question, well, what does it mean? Does it still belong? What does it mean to me? I don't even believe in God. We had people in our company that didn't believe in God. The question for that person was not whether you believed in God or not in order to work for us. How did you treat people? What was your basis for how you treated people? And why? Because that was the end product of the faith is translated into the person that God created. And we had an open environment where faith, we could share faith in our environment. But I often used to say to our folks, I said, you can't come to Service Master today and say, well, I'm going to honor God today, but I don't care about making money. Can't do that. You have to do both. Making money is a means, but you can't ignore it. Or you can't say today, you know what? I'm going to develop people today, but I don't care about serving the customer with excellence. Can't do that. You got all these things have got to fit into your decision making, or you better stop and not make the decision. So, Al, right from the very beginning, right when Service Master was first incorporated in 1947, when they had 12 employees, they looked for the best person to fill the job. They didn't look for a Christian best person to fill the job.
So when you say you were a Christian company?
No. And Al knows my answer to this one because we've had some discussion on it. There was an organization at one time. They've changed their name now. And they do good work, but the original name was the Fellowship of Christian Companies. You've heard, of course, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And they asked me to come and speak at one of their conventions, and I said, I'm sorry, I can't come. And they said, Bill, why not? And I said, I don't know what a Christian company is. And they said, well, doesn't Service Master still have a Bible verse in their annual report every year? And I said, yeah. Don't you still have an honor God? Yeah. I said, you know, based upon my faith, I believe that someday I'm going to be standing in front of my Lord and Savior. And when I look around, I am not going to see any companies. And when I read my Bible and I read the word Christian, it refers to a person. The only organization that in any way fits Christian as an adjective is the church. That's the way I read my Bible.
Talk to us about leadership. How do you go about getting the trust of the people that you lead?
Yeah, well, Al, I think Now, as we go on this answer questions, if you get questions, save them up.
I'm going to make sure that
we want to
the audience gets a half an hour for questions. That's why I'm going to run through some of these.
Let me talk a little bit about my learning on leadership. I talked just briefly this afternoon about the whole concept of servant leadership. Leadership is often, if you want to write a bestseller today, you write it on leadership. I mean, just go look at the books. There's book after book after book on leadership. And it's typically painted as something wonderfully glamorous and so forth. But I found it to be a lot of hard work, sometimes involved with routine and mundane. Drucker says that leadership in and of itself is really not something that should be sought after. And that's kind of a strange statement. But he goes on to say, leadership is just a means. To what end is the question? Now when you look at leadership that way, just that simple statement he said, which I think is also a very profound statement. What is it? What is the end product of your leadership? It gets back to this concept we were talking about earlier, what is your business? Now you can understand why Drucker says management is a liberal art. Because it gets back to the whole question of people. The question about leadership is not so much about you and me. It's about the people who are following and the direction we're leading them. Now when you start unpacking leadership that way, it's pretty important for you to know where you're going yourself and why you're going there if you're going to lead people, because you're leading them in a direction. And it also is fully reflective of what I think Jesus was teaching about leadership. that the end result is the people. And your measurement is going to be in how those people have developed and grown. One of the great both difficulties in leadership and pain in leadership and joys of leadership is what happens to the people that you've touched and led. There's someone here at your convention who is one person I had a great opportunity to work with for many years. He's Steve Preston. He's now the administrator of the Small Business Administration in Washington. And he's speaking in one of these seminars tonight, I think. Steve, is Steve right here? Oh, Steve, okay. But, you know, I mean, he came up to me today, we had a little interaction, and, you know, again, I said, there's Steve. I've had a lot of opportunities of working with Steve and having some input in Steve, and it's great to see him here today. So, I mean, that's part of the joy. We had a practice at Service Master that when someone was appointed to a leadership position, an officer leadership position, one of the things we did was we gave them an opportunity to purchase some Service Master stock. Now, not get a stock option, which is if the stock goes up, it's great. If it goes down, it's no problem. They had to buy it. And so most of the people took advantage of it. But this one time where this person was promoted to be an officer of the company, he called me up 2 days later and said, you know, Bill, I just don't know if I want to buy the stock. Now, we'd already announced that he was a leader. He was going to move and take over this responsibility. And I said, can we sit down and have breakfast tomorrow morning? As you know, I learned something about breakfasts. So we had breakfast that next morning, and I started listening to him, and he said, you know, I just don't know if I want to do this and whether I should do it and so forth. And I said, well, there's something bothering you. I said, are you worried about borrowing? He said, yeah, I'm going to have to borrow the money, and I don't know whether I should. I took the napkin, let's just draw a little T account and tell me what your balance sheet looks like. Well, he didn't know whether that was a very good idea, but he had opened the subject. So we listed the assets on one side of his balance sheet, and he had some cash in the bank. He had already had some Service Master stock. He had a house, and a car, and a boat, and some other small investments. And then we went on the other side and he had a mortgage on his house. And then, what you balance it off? That was his net worth. He said, that's exactly it, Bill, right there, that net worth. He said, if the stock goes down, my net worth goes down. And I'm not ready for that. My wife and I are not ready for that. And I said, you haven't given me all your liabilities. He said, oh yeah. Bill, I'm honest with you, I'm giving you everything. I said, tell me, how many people are working in this unit that you're going to take responsibility for Service Master? And he said, I think there's 800. And I said, well, a year from now, is there going to be an opportunity for 800 people in this unit, 1,000 people, or 600 people? And does your leadership have anything to do with it? How many of the people, of the 800 people, are the principal breadwinners in their home? 50%, 60%, 70%, probably somewhere in there. Yeah. I said, what if those people don't have a job a year from now? Are you responsible at all in relating to their family? How many of these people do you think are sometime in their career are ready for a promotion? The next step. Is it an environment where you're going to have an opportunity for these people to grow in their jobs? Does that have anything to do? How many of these people do you think have kids that they want to send to college and help their kids where their income is important? Now, I was thinking all of the tangible things. I didn't even get into the subject about who they were becoming as people. I was just talking about the tangible things. But now I could start moving into that. Already I had him pretty well whipped by that time. I said, that's an indebtedness far bigger than anything on your balance sheet. That's so much bigger than what you'd have to borrow to buy the stock. And if you don't want to assume that indebtedness, Max DePree calls it the posture of indebtedness of a leader to the people they lead. If you don't want to assume that, don't take the job. Because this isn't just a job that has a title to it. This is a job that has a responsibility to it. And as Drucker said again, a leader has only one choice, to lead or mislead. Only one choice. And the consequences of either affect the people. So,
and you mentioned this afternoon servant leadership, and a part of what you were talking about is servant leadership, but you took servant leadership further than this. Can you share a bit about how you did service days and that kind of thing?
Well, that experience I had of actually doing the service work in those first 8 weeks was such a great reminder to me of the importance of understanding not only the work of our service workers, but what it feels like to be a service worker. You ever been a housekeeper in a hospital? Anybody in the audience have been a housekeeper in a hospital? Okay, the young man in the back. You know what happens to most housekeepers in the hospital? Nobody knows your name. The nurses say, "Hey, you," or the doctor says, "Get out of the room." You go and people don't even call you by your name. You know what it's like to have a mop in your hand all day long? That mop handle becomes pretty important as to how it feels in your hand. There's a whole story about that, about our investment in R&D and mop handles. So one of the things I felt that it was important for everyone in the company at least one day a year to go out and deliver service work. So it didn't make any difference whether you're in an IT department or you're in our finance department or what job you had, officer, whether you were the chairman or the CEO. Every year, that was part of your job. You selected one of the services we did and you went out and did the service work. And it was up to you to schedule that day. But everybody had that as part of their job, all as part of reflecting the principle of being able to serve others. We never allowed any in our parking lots designated spots for certain people. That was for Bolton. And if you had come to our headquarters, you'd see that nobody works behind closed doors. It's all glass. And open office, open mind, that kind of a principle. And when we had conference rooms in the areas where the executives were, the conference rooms were available for everybody in the office, not just for the executives. We needed to be constantly reminded that we're not there for the perks. And I'll tell you, in organizational behavior, perks just accumulate on you. And you get used to them. I have to admit to you, you get used to them. There wasn't a city I could travel in where there wasn't a servicemaster person ready there to meet me at the airport, take me where I wanted to go. It can become insidious, and so you have to work against it. At least that's the way I felt.
Why don't you share the story about the woman who found you with a mop?
Yeah. In that first 8 week period, I was mopping the floor one day in a large hospital in the city of Chicago, in a corridor, a busy corridor. And you've probably seen these in institutions where you set up your wet floor signs and, you know, you're mopping the floor. And people are streaming along one side and you're mopping one side. So I was there with my mop and bucket, and a lady walked by. She stopped. Now this was my first 8 weeks in service master. She looked at me and she said, "Aren't you Bill Pollard?" And I said, "Yes." I didn't really recognize her, and then she identified herself. She was a shirt-tail relative of my wife. And so I remember, "Oh, yeah, sure." And so we talked a little bit, and she looked at me again, and she said, don't you work for Wheaton College? You're still a lawyer, aren't you? So I kind of looked down at my mop and bucket, and I said, no, I have, by now we had a little group of people around us. I said, no, I have a new job. And she was bewildered, and then she leaned over, because we had these other people, she whispered in my ear, she said, is everything all right at home? But we have another story on that, because we had officers coming into the company all the time. And this we developed this process for all of them. And we had a fellow from Boston who was someone we hired to lead our healthcare unit out there. And so he came to the training, and he was training in a Chicago hospital in Roseland. And he went through the cafeteria line, and he sat down at a table with a group of doctors. Now, housekeepers don't normally do that, but he felt comfortable going in, so they were talking to him, and one of the doctors said, well, where do you live? And so this fellow said, well, I live in Boston. The doctor looked at him and said, you live in Boston? He said, when do you see your family? He says, well, I go home every weekend. And so the conversation kind of just ended. And after the doctor takes his tray, he beelines upstairs to the administrator's office. He said, what are you paying these housekeepers around here? They get to go home to Boston every weekend. So anyway, there's all kinds of those kinds of stories. But I can tell you that for me, when I went out every year and experienced my We Serve Day, there was always something I learned about the business, about how our systems meshed or didn't mesh with the person doing the work, the person closest to the customer, the person doing the service work. And, you know, you really got a good feeling of those friction points or lack of frictions, and understanding also, and listening to our service people talk about their job and so forth.
When we think about certain companies in the U.S., and I'll name Enron as one example, we don't think of truth and company leadership. Why don't you say something about truth as a leader of a large corporation?
Yeah, truth is a big subject. And, of course, you've all come through educational experiences, and you know that in some of our universities today there is thought that there is not such a thing as objective truth. But truth can mean what we believe. Truth can be used to describe what occurred, a fact. Truth can be also used to mean full disclosure, or lack thereof. And it's in that latter category that we don't often talk a lot about truth. Now, we don't in our interpersonal relationships, because it's as much a lie for me not to tell you something you should know as to tell you something wrong. If I'm to disclose something to you about something, and I don't, it's a lie. Omission of essential fact is a wrong, as commission is essential fact. So, I think in business, and especially in a growing way, the whole idea of disclosure is a much bigger issue. And as you look at the Enron situation, part of the problem there was clearly deceit in not disclosing. But another part of the problem was the complexity of the transactions. And when you get into disclosure, as far as complexity of transactions, it's harder and harder to get at what was really going on. And then there's that talking about disclosure, that whole question about when is it appropriate not to disclose? And the example I give is that if I'm going in for surgery I do not want a video of what the doctor is going to do the night before the surgery. I really don't. But that's full disclosure, right? So sometimes we have to withhold information. When to withhold information? And here's an area where it gets very, very sensitive with respect to referrals of employees. Let's say an employee has been terminated or has been asked to leave and they've resigned. And then somebody calls you up and says, what do you think about Mary? What do you think about Sam? What do you say? Well, he or she was employed here. Well, if you don't say anything more, well, you've said something, haven't you? So this whole area of truth can become very difficult. But coming back to truth is part of my faith. This is where I think the fact and belief come together, and that's in the truth of Jesus Christ. And let me just tell you a little story about that in relationship to Service Master. And you'll wonder where I'm going, but I think you'll see where when I get there. When I first came to Service Master, my predecessors, one of the things they had done is we had flags flying in front of the company. And one of the flags was the Christian flag. And I kind of thought that was wrong. We shouldn't have a Christian flag flying in front of the company. But I didn't have the guts to take it down when I became CEO. And so, but it always bothered me. And so one day I got an idea when I thought, man, I can take the flag down. And we decided that we were going to honor our employees of 25 years or more and the employee of the company. We put up a wall, a marble wall, where the name was inscribed upon it. In front of that wall, we put a statue, which was a depiction of Jesus washing his disciples' feet. And that was in front of our headquarters, still is in front of the headquarters down in Memphis today. Well, when we put the statue up, we took the Christian flag down. Now, nobody noticed the fact that we took the Christian flag down. Our facilities manager and I were the only one who commented on it. But they sure noticed when the sculpture of Jesus washing his feet went up. And sure enough, within a week, I got barraged by folks in our company of the Jewish faith. They finally said, Phil, you've crossed the line. Now the company has crossed the line. They're making me, if I'm here for 25 years, to have my name with Jesus Christ up there. That you can't do that. So I invited the representatives to come in and visit with me in my office. And so we had a conversation. And I said, number one, would you agree that Jesus was a Jew? And they said, we agree Jesus is a Jew. And I said, would you agree that he lived? Yep, would agree he lived. Would you agree that as he lived, he was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, example of a servant leader? Yeah, we'd agree with that. But we don't agree he's God. And I said, you know what? He's given you that choice. I do. But don't deny that Jesus lived. Don't deny what he did. You have got to resolve how you're going to either accept or not what he said. But don't deny the reality of the fact that he lived. And folks, that's to me, that was a wonderful example. Reality of the incarnation. Now we've just experienced Christmas. And our God cared enough for us to become one of us. That's amazing. That's wonderful. And no one can deny that. Because it happened. That is truth.
Let's see if there are any other questions in the audience. I've got a few more on my list, but I don't think I'm going to get to them. Yes.
Yes.
noticed you said it's large, as you said, it's large in your company. Is that part of your company now?
Well, I don't think it is more prevalent now than it has been. I will tell you what is more prevalent in our company today, and remember I told you we deal with a lot of entry-level employees, is Muslims. The issue at one time was Bible studies and people praying, and some people objecting that there were Bible studies and praying. We never cared. We're going to allow that. Today, the biggest issue is us providing places where people can pray five times a day. We have to and should.
Yeah. Others over here, go ahead. Use the microphone, please.
Thank you. I wonder if you could comment. You mentioned the need to serve your customers and also to help your employees develop their potential. And I'm wondering, is there a virtuous cycle here where if you do take care of your customers and you do, try to develop your employees, the profitability will follow that.
There is a definite cycle, and there's a wonderful book on it called The Service Profit Chain, written by three professors at the Harvard Business School. ServiceMaster was one of the companies they studied, and there is a direct relationship between customer loyalty and profit. In our business, it costs us five times as much to sell a new customer as it does to retain an existing customer. So when your customer retention rate goes up, your profit goes up. The key element in a service business for customer retention is the person serving the customer. And it's not just the person mechanically serving the customer, but warmly serving the customer. So if that person is motivated, it gets back to this Drucker comment. You can't deliver service without trained and motivated, committed people. A quality service. So there's a direct chain here. And they proved it. And there was about 12 companies they studied, and we were one of them. And it is very definitely. Jim Heskett is the primary author of that.
There's one over here.
In today's environment, the story you told about the statue and the marble that honored your employees, and we have people that are, savagely ripping each other apart or taking them in courthouse. So when you said that, being low devil's advocate, I saw a courier coming up to you with a letter from the ACLU. So in 2006, how do you address that?
I think. You address it by the fact that Jesus lived. He's an historical figure. There's a great theologian in England who taught at Harvard, at Oxford for 20 years before he went into the ministry. I can't remember his name now. He's a bishop now in the Anglican Church. Anyway, he used to say to his academic friends when they said, "Do you really think that Jesus was God?" His response was, "I don't know enough about God to know whether Jesus was God. I know enough about Jesus to know that God was Jesus."
Right here. One of the questions that Jeff, I thought that was very articulate and preempting four very tough questions. But I thought one of the questions that was not addressed, which I thought it was just tough to make, is if profit is a means to a greater end, say providing a good service to help so that a community can flourish, those two things that he mentioned. How can we justify that when shareholders own the company and capital is provided to a company potentially under the goal of getting a return and profit,
and therefore, so the question is really around the agency issue of profit. And I asked Jeff a little bit.
Remember now. The shareholder owns the company. The shareholders own the company, right? So they provided the capital, right? So they're entitled to return on the capital. And that's part of the profit. But before the profit gets to a return on the shareholder, employees have been paid, right? Taxes have been paid. All those are contributors to the community. If you didn't have, when people work for private industry, they are net contributors. When people work for a municipality or a government, the pay is coming from taxes to support that government. So when you think of the deducts from the bottom line, all of that's a flow of profit. Now, am I not understanding your question?
No, I think that it adds an interesting dimension. It's just I guess what I mean is.
Is wealth bothering you?
I think he's on the other side.
Okay.
Bill.
Yeah.
So if profit is not the ends of a business,
yeah.
As a shareholder, one might argue, like, well, no, I want you to maximize profits. You know, if suppose you're, you don't share the same principal values about business as a bad person.
Right.
And you look at a business purely as a means of generating income. Now, wouldn't a person running a company be not doing that shareholder justice because they're not performing the duties that they were paid to do?
Right.
And how would you address that? I mean, I kind of
when is there enough profit, or when is there too much profit? How much is enough? I mean, is that kind of what you're driving at?
Yes, a little bit. It's I guess I'm just driving at the question of ultimately, you know, we're taught that at many of the business schools that business is about maximizing shareholder value. So if you're not doing that, aren't you not doing what you're
right.
supposed to do?
Well, let me just say, maximizing shareholder value is very important, but is it long-term value or short-term value? Right? And if you're not maximizing long-term value, you're missing the mark. And if you look at the way shareholders come in and out of stock today, if you're a public company, they're moving all the time. Typically, it's your individual base that stays, but the institutional investors are moving in and out all the time. There's no way you can earn enough money for them because they'll be out thinking you won't do it. At ServiceMaster, we had up profit quarters every quarter for 24 years. Now, you can imagine what happened. I mean, at the end of the first two or three years, we get people getting out because we wouldn't do it. And then the people coming in, and then people going out, and then people coming in, and then people going out. And they're going, yeah, right. And then we didn't have an up quarter after 24 years. And everybody thought everything was going to fall out the window. So I do think there's an interesting story. If you haven't read it, it's a great story to read by Tolstoy. How much land does a man need? Has anybody read that? It's a story about a Russian peasant who finally is able to save enough money to buy a small piece of land. And he works it well. and then he's able to make enough money to buy a bigger piece of land. And he works it well. And he's able enough money to buy a bigger piece of land. Works that well. And then he decides he's heard about this land across the mountains where he can get a much bigger piece of land. So he goes over there, and the chieftains over there say, yes, we'll sell you the land that you can get around in a day. You start at sunrise, and you're back at sunset. But you got to complete the loop, or we won't sell it to you. And we'll sell it to you for this price, no matter how big that piece of land is. So the boy said, great. He was up the next morning, started out running. Then he walked, and then he went a little further, and then he went a little further, and all of a sudden he said, boy, the sun's up there, and I'm not halfway back yet. So now he starts walking a little faster, and now he walks a little faster. Finally, the sun is going down, and he's still got a ways to go, and he starts running pell-mell. And 100 yards before the finish line, he drops over dead of a heart attack. How much land does a man need? 6 feet.
We have time for a couple more. Where's the microphone?
You mentioned earlier that that profit is required for everything, for a family, for a government, for a business. And there's a verse in Ecclesiastes in 10:19 that says, a feast is made for laughter, and wine makes life merry, but money is the answer for everything. I was just wondering if that...
Money is the answer for everything? Is that what it says?
Yeah.
That's a wonderful interpretation. I hadn't read that one yet. Okay.
It's in the Bible.
Yeah, okay, right. But it's in Ecclesiastes, too. Remember, that has some wonderful statements in it. Like,
so I was just curious as to what you thought about that verse, or if that related to what you were saying.
Well, I think whenever you take money or profit as an end objective, you have everything that's involved in greed, in the worst sense of the word, and you miss the mark completely. And I think the message of Jesus time and time again says that. So there's no question about that. But also the reality of this world that he created is the principle of profit. It's an essential principle.
Just a quick question. Do you ever stop with greed?
Yes. Well, you know, I deal with it. That's a great question. How do I deal with it? I can't say I've got a consistent system of dealing with it, other than to have, first of all, conscience about it. The second, I think it is wise for every person who has had an opportunity to have the acquisition of wealth to understand that God owns that. And as part of that understanding with respect to my wife and I, we are in a role of not just giving but investing in God's work, and with the objective that there'll be no probate in our estates. There'll be nothing left to have probate or will of.
There's a bunch of hands up, so we need to go to a new person. There's a lot of them there.
I just had a question about your wife. You talked about her in your introduction, and you had mentioned that you are over 47 years growing together, and that you probably have different personalities. And I was just wondering how she fits into your success and what she's done and what you've done to go on that journey together successfully.
Well, we complement each other. Hopefully I compliment her. I know she compliments me. But my wife has been someone that I can always talk about anything with, and she can talk about it with me. So she's been a great sounding board for me. My wife has a wonderful, wonderful ability to relate. She had a wonderful ability to relate to our children. So our kids during their teenage years would come home and talk to her about things that they wouldn't talk to me about. And one of her transitions now in life is that now that they're mature, they talk to me more about things than they talk to her about. So she had to go through that cycle too. So we complement each other. She always kind of wrestles with this question when we go to places together, and we've done a lot of traveling together. When she has to put down what has she accomplished? She's been a homemaker all her life, and she's been a very important part of this family of ours. That's been her role, and a role that she's really enjoyed.
Where's the microphone?
Jeff talked about how, as we're creating the image of God, that our ideal work would express our identity, give us potential for significance and creativity, and much work in the world is just dehumanizing or maybe just monotonous, boring. How, as employers or managers, how can we give people opportunity for creativity and to express their identity and have significance when there's work that has to be done that may not give a lot of room for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something we kept working at in our company, and I think it starts to get defining the job. And understanding that the job, for example, is more than cleaning the floor. In the hospital, for example, we had programs that helped our housekeepers understand the importance of their job in helping people get well. So every week, there would be a two-hour session where someone else from the hospital would come down and talk to them about how housekeeping related to the surgeon, how housekeeping related to the head nurse, and so forth. So they began to see a dimension and meaning in their work. I think it's also the importance of looking at the job and the person as the subject of work and not just the object of work. And I'll give you this last illustration on that. In the early 1990s, I was asked to come to the Soviet Union and talk about the free enterprise system. This was right at Glasnost and Perestroika and so forth. And I was in Moscow and then Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg again. But when I was in Leningrad, I came down one day in my hotel and I saw this woman mopping the floor of the hotel. I know something about mopping floors. And she was taking the most amount of time doing the least amount of motions in mopping a floor of anyone I had seen ever mop a floor. So I decided to go over and talk to her with my interpreter. And you know what she was using to mop that floor? She was using a wooden tea frame with a dirty rag wrapped around it and a dirty bucket of water. You know, she was just moving dirt from one place to another. But I talked enough to Olga to know that if I had gone to her two-room apartment, I probably could have eaten off the floor. The next week, I was in Guy's Hospital in London, where we serve. And I was introduced as a chairman to the housekeepers. And one of the housekeepers came over and hugged me, embraced me, and then wanted to take me on a tour of her wards, showing me the tools and the other things that she had been trained to do. She was proud of her work and proud of herself. Now, these two people were doing basically the same tasks. But one was treated as a subject of work, and the other was just treated as the object of work. Same tasks. So it's not just in the task, but it's also in how the person is treated and how that is elevated.
I think we have time for just one more question. So where's the microphone? She's had her hand up for quite a while and very high, so maybe you can get it to her.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, have you ever had to lay off anybody in your company to increase profit or simply to sustain your company for a period of time? And do you think that layoffs are absolute evils or sometimes necessary evils? And if they're necessary evils, how do you justify them?
Okay. Yes, we've had to lay off people, and it's been in situations primarily where a unit has shrunk versus grown. And the reason why that unit shrank was inadequate leadership. And that is part of the pain of misleading versus leading. Now we've had to fire people too because they didn't do the job. But that's another dynamic business we haven't talked about. A business never stays the same. It either grows or shrinks. Never stays like this. It's either going this way or it's going down. And the consequences are there sometimes in people. It comes not only in growth, but also comes sometimes in the administration of compensation. All you have to do is take a calculator and see what kind of a wage you'd be paying to someone if you just automatically increase their wages every year by 5 or 6%. If that's your salary administration program, you're heading towards a cliff where you're going to push people off.
Well, I think we've come to the end of a very nice session. Thank you so much, Bill. Let's give him a hand.